I don't get the music, so we'll go to Bart in a couple of minutes to explain that, but not right now. I want to get started. I love the fall backdrop. I don't know if it's a specific place. We'll go to Bart in a couple of minutes and he can explain if it's just general or if this is something, or maybe Irma set it up. I don't know. I was in New Jersey 2 weeks ago hoping to get some fall, but it was like a record warm October in the East Coast and there were no, all the leaves were still green. It was also like 100 degrees in LA 2 weeks ago, so it's crazy. I'm going to talk, I got two stories about New Jersey, not just that I was there. By the way, doing a show like this solo in front of a camera and all that is really hard. I don't know why I want to do it, but I like doing it better than, when I have something to talk about, I like it a lot better than having the partners. But today I don't have a lot to talk about, so today is really hard. I got a short list here, and I'm going to try to supplement it with a little bit about what's going on at TYT. Malcolm always asks me to do that. So this is a Friday postgame show, by the way. I think there's the Thursday postgame show, so I don't know if I should pretend that it's actually Thursday or Friday, is also canceled. But it's not Saturday. But I might, if I had more, I would split this up and do two postgame shows, but I don't. So welcome to the Friday postgame show. Steve is out, Malcolm's out. I'm glad to have the opportunity to do it all by myself, even though I'm a little weak today. So before I start talking about what's going on at TYT, all right, what's the music and anything special about the fall colors behind me?
Fall colors, I did not choose. I think Irma did. Irma did, yes, she did.
Is it something specific or is just a nice picture?
Something specific in... No, not really something specific, just a nice picture. And plus, it's cold outside in California.
Yeah, it's dreary and gray today.
Yeah, so yesterday. Basically, if it fits the theme, even though we don't get the wonderful fall colors.
Right, okay, so. Got it. So it's just a general nice fall foliage picture.
Yeah, just nice general. You know, plus, it makes you warm and fuzzy.
Right. And so what's up with the music? Was there something funny about that?
Well,
that I missed?
Before I get to the music, it's not cold in California. And here in California, as a native person of Los Angeles, seasons are overrated. That's just my take. Yeah. And as far as the music, for me, I just like to pick goofy music because everything around me and the world that I live in is so serious. And I just play stuff like that just to take the edge off and take the weight of the world off of people's shoulders.
Okay,
that's all.
I don't want
just lighting the mood.
I don't want to lose the audience. So thank you for how long have we been on air? 4 minutes. I'm glad you stuck it through. Now we'll get to the heart of this. Everyone loves to hear about what's going on at TYT. I don't have anything juicy, but I don't know what Cenk and Anna talked about. If you guys do, so if I repeat something, jump in. But we had a Halloween costume party yesterday that 9 people I think participated in out of 50. Because the instructions, no one understood. Dress up as your favorite meme. I don't even know what a meme is.
I don't know like what memes normally wear. So it's like that's one reason why I didn't dress up. But another reason is like I'm too busy living. I don't have time to dress up for Halloween.
You make ridiculous excuses. That's part of life. We all Halloween. We talk about it every year. Some people love it. Some people hate it. I'm in the I like it camp. So I wanted to participate. I didn't know how, so I went to Google and I typed meme and I clicked images and I just looked through all of them until I found one that said, oh, I could dress up like that. And it was a guy with sunglasses and a bandana and a gray shirt and black pants. So I put that on. I printed out a copy of it so people would understand. And that was my meme. And I won a prize. I won a $25 gift certificate to Starbucks.
Why didn't you go to your normal David Kohler, I work at Walmart costume like you done?
Because that's not a meme.
You can make it a meme, dude.
No, that has to be done by me. So that went on, and it was fun, even though participation was kind of low. And then we had chicken wings and pizza and some cake pops. Other things going on, there's a big technological upgrade that I'm spending a lot of time on. It's our health insurance open enrollment, and that's sucking up a lot of my time. I could have probably been done with it, but I spent hours preparing the 4 stories I have for this postgame show. So that's taking up a lot of time. There's a lot of new people. We beefed up our website development team. In a few months, maybe even in a few weeks, you'll start seeing the impact of that. But bringing all those people on has taken some time. But there's a lot of hubbub, a lot of activity. I think morale is pretty good and things are going well here at TYT. So, I mean, that's my little non not revealing too much. Yeah, you can't talk internally about things that are not, that the public's not privy to here too much. There's some confidentiality that has to be maintained. But that's what's going on at TYT. So now let's get to the few stories I have. First, I want to update something that I talked about on my other interview show, Reporting In, where I interview the TYT reporters and commentators. I was talking to one of our freelance reporters who's covering some legislation activity in Congress, I think. I already forgot what it was. But I mentioned at that time that I had recently read a story about an obscure little provision that Congress put into a bill decades ago that completely revolutionized the electrical industry. And I said that in a postgame show I would explain. So that's what I'm going to do. So the industry in question is the electric utilities, the power generating industry. And for decades throughout the 20th century, they operated basically as a monopoly, all powerful. They could do whatever they want. They had the monopoly power to generate all electricity in the country. And they had what's called, I don't know if I'm going to pronounce it right, monopsony power. They were the only buyer of electricity. So even if someone wanted to generate some alternative electricity, wind, renewable resources, cogeneration, they could only sell it if the power companies chose to buy it or not, and usually they didn't. So all those little alternative energy options did not exist. Then Jimmy Carter in the 70s, as you remember, as you should know, wanted to improve our energy system here in the country, reduce consumption, and get on a more sustainable path. And his administration put forward the PURPA, Public Utilities, I don't remember what all the letters stand for, but it's a Public Utilities Regulation Act. And there was an obscure section 210 in there that no one really cared about. There was a senator from New Hampshire who had in his state a trash incineration company that was generating a lot of extra heat when they burned their trash. And they wanted to use that heat, that's what cogeneration is, to use that heat to drive a turbine to create a little bit of electricity on the side. But they couldn't do it because nobody would buy it from them because the electrical utilities had the sole right to choose to buy or not buy power from a cogen plant. So this senator put a little clause into the bill that no one seemed to really care about, section 210. And for a while it was taken out, but then he put it back in. And the utilities were so busy fighting off all other parts. This was a giant, giant piece of legislation that they just let this one slide, and it got passed. And it opened the floodgates in the coming years and decades for all these alternative power sources, particularly in California with wind energy. But cogeneration use increased, wind energy, alternative sources, they all blossomed due to this obscure provision. And it really helped it, to be brief, modernize to the extent that it's been modernized, the entire electrical generation system of the United States, all because of this one tiny little clause that no one seemed to care about at the time that one senator pushed for. It also speaks to the power that one senator can have if he or she uses it correctly. Often we're frustrated when there's a senator like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, who you support, but they feel like you can't do anything. They're one in a Senate of 99, they have no power. But sometimes a clever senator who pushes a little provision can have a tremendous influence, as in the case of that Section 210 in PURPA back in 1978. So that closes the circle on that story. I want to follow up on another thing I spoke about in the last time I did a solo postgame show, I think, which was a long time ago. It's the herbicide dicamba. At the time, I think I called it a pesticide, and I was corrected by the audience. But it's an herbicide that's it's another one of these devious Monsanto-type arrangements. I forget if Monsanto is the company that makes it. It's a conglomeration of companies. But they sell genetically modified organisms, crops, that are resistant to this herbicide, but not to others. And that forces the farmers to buy and utilize dicamba on their fields. The problem is, when you spray a field, the wind blows the herbicide away, and it goes to other crops that are not genetically modified to resist that herbicide, and it damages them. And this is blowing up, particularly in Arkansas and Missouri. And now those states, especially in Arkansas, my angle at the time, you know, a state that's really Republican and get the government out of my life nonsense rhetoric, now is pleading with the government and the EPA to help them because this dicamba's destroying crops. The EPA had a meeting on this recently, and they estimate that 4% of soybean crops in the U.S. have been damaged due to this dicamba. So it's an ongoing issue, and that's the update on that. I also spoke in that post-game show, I believe, about how the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe called a snap election because he was confident that he would have good support in the public. And then I warned him, look, that's been tried a couple times in recent years, and it hasn't gone well. These surprise elections, as soon as the people get a chance to vote, their frustrations, whether it's in England with Brexit or in the US with Trump or in France, that they're ruling out, they're voting out the establishment parties. And I said, Japan is not Western Europe, and I don't know anything about Japan, so maybe it won't follow that pattern. But I warned him that this could be risky. He had the snap election, and it's a good thing he didn't listen to me. He won overwhelming support from the people. And I think yesterday, you know, this week, he was reelected with a huge majority in parliament to be prime minister of Japan. So Shinzo Abe, his political gamble pays off big time. And now he's a stronger prime minister. Part of what helped him was the fear of what's going on with North Korea. And whenever there's external danger, people rally around the leader. I think I mentioned I was going to talk a story or two about New Jersey. So the first one is small and maybe just funny. New Jersey recently passed a more strict law about distracted driving. You cannot have a cell phone in your hand when you're driving a car. I like that law. One of the first people who was busted for it, pulled over and given a ticket, $250, was Chris Christie's wife, the First Lady of New Jersey. She was driving with a phone in her hand. Cops pulled her over. She said, I wasn't making a call. They said, it doesn't matter. You can't have a phone in your hand. They fined her. She didn't fight it. She paid. For all I know, though, this was set up, who knows, to get publicity for the law, maybe. But it's a juicy little irony if it wasn't set up. The other story coming out of New Jersey is possibly, you know, Chris Christie, whose career has been absolutely wrecked. His reputation is in the toilet, but he's the point man on this opioid crisis. So maybe he's trying to make amends with his reputation. But the New Jersey Attorney General, so under Christie's approval, is suing the maker of OxyContin, which is a not well-known pharmaceutical company named Purdue. And they're suing Purdue for damages for the opioid crisis and all the health crisis and lives ruined and deaths caused and costs incurred in the state of New Jersey. And I think that's a great development. That's the system trying to fix a problem in society. That suit, I think it was just announced now this week, so there's not much of an update to it, but that's good to know. Now, this comes on top of a big New Yorker magazine expose on the family that founded that company, Purdue Pharma. It's the Sackler family, a very wealthy family that has donated millions upon millions of dollars to museums and universities and public institutions all across the country. There are famous wings of museums and buildings named after them. And this is their way to whitewash the apparently the crimes that they've committed. Whether they're legal crimes or not, we'll wait to see. But crimes against society by pushing OxyContin on society and getting millions of people addicted and ruining thousands of lives and costing untold millions of dollars to states and local jurisdictions who have to treat these massive opioid epidemic across the country. So just like the New Yorker article is what blew the door open partially on the Harvey Weinstein scandal, maybe this New Yorker article, along with other things, is going to blow the door open finally once and for all on this legalized drug peddling by the big pharmaceutical companies, of which OxyContin and opioids are a big example. I don't know how many comments I'm going to get for my inability to pronounce opioids. I'm beginning to sound like Cenk a little bit there. Another obscure thing that went on this week, or that I read about this week, the EPA issued a report, I believe, talking about how the reduction in of the maximum allowed standard for arsenic in drinking water in public water supplies, by reducing the maximum allowed, they have reduced cancers of the liver and bladder by 17% since I think 2014 was the study. And that's hundreds of fewer cancers per year in the United States. Hundreds is not that big a number, but it's some. And the reason I remember this is because it takes me back to 2001. 2001, George Bush had just been elected, and there was nothing going on. There was no news. In fact, it's a good thing the Young Turks didn't exist that summer, so there was nothing to talk about. The biggest stories, I think, were this Natalie Holloway missing. I think that was occurring around there. There was that intern in DC who got killed, and people suspected Congressman Gary Condit. That was the biggest story in the news. And the other big story was the arsenic standard. Clinton had attempted to bring down the arsenic standard for drinking water from 50 parts per billion to 10. And the Bush administration, which had just come into office, didn't agree with that. And they wanted to bring it back or keep it at 50 and refused to do Clinton's rule. And it created an outrage in the press and the environmental community. And later in that year, Bush actually, or the Bush administration, and Christine Todd Whitman, who was one of the two reasonable people in the Bush administration. I can't remember who the other one. Oh, the other one was Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill. But anyway, Christine Todd Whitman pushed for the 10 parts per billion, the more strict standard. She eventually won the day on that argument. It was still delayed for many years. I think it didn't go into effect until 2006, maybe later. Maybe into the Obama administration. But finally, yes, the Clinton era proposal of 10 parts per billion prevailed. And according to this recent EPA study, it has reduced cancers by 17% of lung and bladder cancers. Whether you don't need to know the numbers because they're subject to dispute, of course. But arsenic is a poison by any stretch of the imagination. There's no way that the standard should be 50 parts per billion. At the time, in the Clinton administration, The strong environmentalists wanted the standard to be 5 parts per billion. 10 parts per billion was the compromise to give industry a little bit of break. But Bush wanted to keep it at 50 at first. Fortunately, he lost, and the public is better off for it. By the way, I was reading in this, there's one congressman from Idaho. I don't know if he's still in office. He single-handedly caused a delay to the implementation of this rule after it was approved. And in exchange, he was bought off by just $7,500 of campaign donations by two pesticide companies that have arsenic in their product. Such a tiny little bit amount of campaign donations to cause him to create all sorts of obstacles in the implementation of this rule and cause who knows how many cancers while we were waiting for the rule to pass as it eventually did. And of course, that's Cenk's number one theme. These politicians are so cheap to buy off. $7,500 campaign donations for Mike Simpson, and that's enough for him to block the rule. It's embarrassing and horrible for our democracy. So the final thing I wanted to talk about is, maybe it's not the final thing. And Bart, if you want to chime in on this one, just because it's always good to have someone in. I usually don't like to talk about the Trump hot button items, but I want to go back to what he said a few weeks ago to the widow of that soldier killed in the ambush in Niger, where he told the wife, well, I guess that's what your husband signed up for, but it still hurts anyway. Now, by any stretch of the imagination, by any standard, that is a horrible, insensitive thing to say to someone, a grieving wife or family member. But what I would like the public to hear when Trump says that is, especially the young people who are considering signing up for the military, I'd like them to hear, yeah, your political leaders don't give a shit about your life. So there are reasons to sign up for the military, some good ones, some personal ones, or some are noble. And if you want to do it, do it. But don't for a second pretend that the people who are going to send you into combat care or give a shit about you. They don't. And Trump, and this is what people like about him, he unveils these secrets. When the politicians hide behind the glorious, the glorification and the ceremonies, that's all propaganda to get people to sign up for the military. And I don't really like that either. I think that's in some ways worse. It's more sensitive and it's not as personal as the conversation with the widow of a dead soldier. But it, I think, has a damaging effect. It gets people to sign up for the military for the wrong reasons. Do you have anything on that?
Well, briefly, you know, it's messed up what Trump said about that. But at the same time, I'm not surprised coming from a guy who's pretty much lived a life that is totally detached from
sacrifice.
Normal people. Yeah, and all that other stuff. And for me, it's like, if you're going to be pursuing a life, a career in the military, you know, you kind of got to figure sooner or later, you're going to have to like participate in warfare in one form or another. And even when I was growing up, I had the thought of joining the military, and a recruiter was there at my school, and then and he was selling the goods of like, hey, you'll get money to go to college and all the wonderful prizes you'll get in joining the military. And I asked him a question, like, if I were to join the military, would I have to participate in fighting a war? And his answer was basically, in a time like that, when your country calls you to participate and join, yes, you will have to. And that was pretty much the game changer for me, why I did not want to join the military.
Did you expect a different answer to that question?
Pretty much, yeah.
What did you expect him to say?
It's like, no, sometimes you will and sometimes you won't, or something like that. But he flat out told me, yeah, you're going to have to fight in a war. And I'm like, okay, thank you very much. I don't want to be a cannon fodder in the next war or whatever. That to me is like, okay, you kind of figure out this is what you're going to get when you sign up for the military. And lastly, I wouldn't be good in the military anyways, because I'm the last person you want in a foxhole, and I'm not into sacrifice and all that. Yes, it may sound selfish and bad and everything, but I'm just keeping it real, you know? That's just not my scene.
Yeah, okay, but it's not about you, but
exactly, it's not.
All right, so, and speaking of war, yeah, we owe more follow-up conversation on Ken Burns' Vietnam War documentary. Today would be a good day to do it, but I didn't really prepare or think about it much. I watched it to the end, except I missed two episodes in the middle, but that doesn't matter. I guess we could talk about the last few episodes. The documentary was great from beginning to end. I did feel guilty that it was so entertaining. It's not supposed to be entertaining. It was a horrible period in the country's history and the world history, especially in Vietnam's history. And a lot of people died and suffered. And now it's you know, entertainment. But getting past that, I learned a lot. It crystallized a lot of, yeah, I learned about the Vietnam War growing up in school and all, but in little bits and pieces here and there, this kind of tied it all together for me. It was good in that sense. I found the Richard Nixon part interesting. I haven't read if conservatives complained about the documentary. I'm sure they did, and they probably said that it cast Nixon in a bad light. I don't know, I'm guessing. I actually thought the documentary was in some ways fair or even favorable to Nixon. Sure, it highlighted about half a dozen awful things that he did, but it made it very clear that he was committed to reducing the American involvement in the war. And he did over time. Maybe it took longer than people want. Maybe he had a couple setbacks and detours that caused a lot of death and damage, extra bombings, incursions into other countries, etc. But he got America to wind down its involvement in Vietnam, which is what the public wanted in the 1968 election. So he accomplished that with lies and deceit along the way, but he did that. The last episode spent a lot of time on the fall of Saigon, and it was gripping, and I was really into it. It was a minute-by-minute account, which I liked, but I didn't put a stopwatch on the different scenes in the documentary, but it seems like they spent more time on the fall of Saigon, which was almost an irrelevant story because it was inevitable. It was bound to happen. It was a very fascinating little minute-by-minute description, but it got a lot more attention than maybe some of the battles earlier in the war that the documentary spent less time on. While I'm thinking, do you have any comments on anything I've said, Bart, or anything you remember from the tail end of that series?
Yeah, but going back briefly to Nixon, and the thing that I liked about the documentary is that Nixon pretty much wanted to interfere in the proposed peace talks. He didn't want the peace talks to happen. The reason why he didn't want it to happen because he wanted to be president of the United States.
Yeah,
and that just rings bad to a lot of people. And conservatives may have a pissing match about that, but that's history.
I'm glad you brought it up. Yeah. I said that the documentary talked about five or six, half a dozen terrible things Nixon did. That's probably the top of the list, and it's unforgivable. It's treason, as Lyndon Johnson called it. So he interfered with the peace talks during the 1968 presidential campaign to try to help himself get elected. And his ploy, it didn't fail. He got elected. So possibly it worked. It helped.
Another thing I liked about the documentary, a couple things, was I really enjoyed the very first part of the documentary talking about the early history of especially the French being involved in Vietnam. And I didn't know about that in school. You know, they didn't teach about that in the history books and going to school. I briefly found out about that from a deleted scene from the movie Apocalypse Now. So I really enjoyed the early part of the documentary talking about the French involvement. There was another part of the documentary that I liked. It was in mid-August 1969. I can't remember the soldier's name. He was in battle and he saved a lot of soldiers' lives and got a medal and everything.
The Japanese guy? The Japanese American?
No, it was, I think his name was Tim or Tom. I can't remember. All I remember is his heroic action and what he did in mid-August, and then what America did, but a few days later after his heroic action, a bunch, you know, there was Woodstock, and watching that and seeing that in the documentary and that soldier's action, it was just another example. Yeah, it was just another example of how America at that time was so disconnected from the Vietnam War. And finally, another thing I liked about it was towards the end of the documentary, the personal stories of how the soldiers from both sides of the war, you know, reconnected and healed whatever personal wounds the Vietnam War Memorial. You know, soldiers coming back to Vietnam and visiting that country many, many years later after their participation in the war. I really enjoyed that. And also, in conclusion, for me, is like what I got out of the documentary is that we do not learn from history. History will repeat itself because it's going to happen. And we don't learn from our lessons and our mistakes in history. And we didn't learn it during the Iraq War. And sure enough, you know, whatever next, you know, war we're going to participate in, we're not going to learn the histories of what we learned from the past. But on the same note, the thing that I liked about the documentary is the personal stories and how people try to pick up their lives and go forward. So overall, I really enjoyed the documentary.
Yeah, well, I enjoyed it too. Ken Burns, yeah, he's masterful at making documentaries. He's getting a lot of crap now about his Civil War documentary, which is 10, 15, 20, I don't know how many years old it is at this point, which was also very well done. But when Chief of Staff John Kelly made his comment about how the Civil War could have been avoided by compromise, that harkens back a little to the attitude that Ken Burns took toward the Civil War. According to this commentator, wherever I read it, and I saw that Civil War, so he's right, Ken Burns didn't really emphasize slavery too much in the Civil War and how it was a war caused by slavery that was needed to end slavery. He kind of sugarcoated or whitewashed a little bit that part of the history. And he certainly made Robert E. Lee out to be an honorable man. as well. So when John Kelly makes that historically incorrect and slightly offensive comment, he is echoing Ken Burns' perspective on the Civil War from that documentary. The final episode with the emotional scenes talking about the Vietnam War Memorial was great emotional manipulation of the audience. I fell for it. It was good stuff, but that was not particularly informative or educational. It was it was more about the experience of watching that series of documentaries and learning about the war and just feeling, not just learning about it, but feeling what a painful impact it had on individuals and the country. So in that sense, Ken Burns did a great job, in the sense that if you want to have a cold, detached analysis of the Vietnam War, a lot of that last episode with all of its closure was superfluous. But it's entertainment. He's got to get people to watch. So I get it. And it was great. It was well done. And probably better done than this postgame show. But both, sadly, Ken Burns' documentary and this Friday postgame show have to come to an end. Thank you for being members and for putting up with this. And perfect timing. I had to take this call. So have a good weekend.